I'd like to first of all welcome you to this guest lecture by Dr. Michael Wesch, and also welcome to the people at Manhattan campus and anywhere else in cyberspace. Dr. Wesch is a cultural anthropologist, and as you probably know, has produced a number of videos on YouTube which have consistently ranked in the top 10. He'll be talking today about Web 2.0 and learning environments. I heard him yesterday, and you're going to be totally amazed. Right?
All right, so I'm going to talk about a couple things. Ultimately, I want to talk about media literacy, but to get there, I need to talk about my classroom, and I'm going to show you sort of some of the things that I've been struggling with in my classroom, which is a lot like this room here. In fact, you can sort of see the audience there. That's a picture of my classroom in the background there. It's very similar to this kind of room, and there's a lot of challenges involved in teaching in this kind of room, especially when you're trying to create an engaging learning atmosphere. But before I start, I just want to mention I've only been teaching for 4 years, and when I think back to 4 years ago when I started, like every assumption about education and information that I walked in with on that first day just was completely shattered within the first 3 years of teaching. And it had a lot to do with new media, new types of technologies that were all around me, that were around in 2004, things like blogs and wikis and stuff like that. But I had never really considered their total impact and what they really mean for education until just about 2 years ago. And then 2 years ago is when it sort of dawned on me, and if you've seen Web 2.0, The Machine Is Using Us, that video was sort of made out of that inspiration of realizing, wow, everything's changed, like we really need to think about things in a new light. So I'm going to try to explain what I mean by that in the first bit here. But ultimately, I'm going to show you what I call a portal to media literacy, which is basically just this portal that we play with in a classroom like this that's designed to bring students together, to work together in new ways, in ways that actually allow them to explore new media while also using the new media to learn about the subject that we're learning about. So I want to start off just by demonstrating the big problem that I have in this particular classroom. So this is the classroom. It looks a lot like this classroom, as you can see. And this is the problem. I did a survey there, and I asked how many do not actually like school, just a simple like raise your hand survey. And this is crazy, right? Because these people pay good money to come to school, and it turns out that over half raise their hands. So over half of them actually don't even want to be sitting there where they're sitting. And then I changed the question a little bit, and I said how many do not like learning, and I got no hands. So you have a situation where you have a bunch of people who really like to learn, but they hate the institution that they've been that's been created for learning. So there's something going on there. And then we just had a little exercise where students could hold up signs about their education, like some demonstration of what they thought about their education. And we got things like this. I Facebook through most of my classes. I bring my laptop to class when I'm not working on class stuff. This is probably very familiar to you guys. I buy $100 textbooks that I never open. My neighbor paid for class but never comes. We did a survey because students wanted to know, you know, how much everybody was reading and so on. And this was across the board. This wasn't just in my class. We found that students completed about 49% of the readings. This is self-report. So they self-reported that they read 49%. And they found only 26% relevant to their life. And so this is a situation where three out of every four things that students read, they don't even think are relevant to their life. So this is a big problem. So then I started paying attention to my faculty peers, just talking in the hallway. We all complain about this type of situation all the time. We complain about students not being engaged in this kind of stuff. And this statement comes up all the time. Some students are just not cut out for school. But then when you really think about it, if school is for learning and then you replace learning for school in that statement, it comes out some students are just not cut out for learning, which totally doesn't make any sense because being human is all about learning. It's the hallmark of humanity. You're basically saying some students are just not human. Unless you're willing to say that school, there's something wrong with the school system itself. So there's something wrong here. We need to do something. So then I started looking around at the classrooms in which we were teaching in, classrooms like this. And I thought, you know, if students learn what they do, like classic Dewey, you know, educational perspective here, what are they learning sitting here? What are they actually learning as they sit in these classrooms? So if these walls could talk, what would they say? And so then we just like We actually did this with the students. I had them kind of look around the room and help me brainstorm, like, what is the message of this classroom? Like, what is this classroom telling you about education? And the first thing was that it is that to learn is to acquire information. And so there's nothing else about this room. This room clearly doesn't say that to learn is to discuss information or to critique information or anything like that. It's clearly about acquiring information. The whole room is designed as an information dump where the professor comes to the front of the room and dumps information on the students. The second thing then is that information is scarce and hard to find. That's why we need these special rooms where you can put the expert in front of the room and dump the information out. And you know, maybe this might have made sense in the past, but it doesn't today. The third thing is to trust authority for good information. So the expert at the front of the room is the authority, and that you should trust that authority for good information. The fourth thing is that authorized information is beyond discussion. And the way the room says this is that, like, these chairs, I think, actually swivel a little bit. So, you know, maybe, like, these could be good for discussion. Maybe you could at least turn to your neighbor. But these are clearly, like, fixed chairs facing the front of the room. The whole room is designed simply for this information dump, not for discussion. So then you can sort of summarize this as saying it's all about obey the authority and follow along. But there's something worse about this, and that is that students take these same expectations to those wonderful small classrooms that every once in a while we get to teach, where we have, you know, under 20 students and it's perfect for discussion and this kind of thing. And yet you find, or at least I find, that students are often bringing the expectations of the big classroom into the small classroom, and I get a bunch of students who still don't want to discuss, who maybe don't even have, they haven't really learned how to ask the types of questions that are good for discussion, and this has been a real problem. And the bigger problem here is I started paying attention to what students are saying inside these walls. And I pay really close attention to questions, because I think questions are sort of the catalyst for great learning. And if you have if you have the right question, you really set your students up to learn and learn and learn. They can just like go on this great quest if they have the right question. But unfortunately, types of questions asked in these walls are things like, how many points is this worth? And you guys are all familiar with these types of questions. How long does this paper need to be? And my least favorite of all, what do we need to know for this test? Because it actually is saying, like, I'm only going to learn so much, okay? So just tell me what I need to know. And then the learning sort of stops there. And of course, they forget it the next day. So this is what I call the crisis of significance. Students are not finding any meaning in their education beyond just getting a grade. And that is very problematic. So somehow we need to get beyond that. There's something in the air here that's actually changed everything, and it's just in the last 5 years. And this is where all the assumptions that you see built into the room start to be subverted. And that something in the air is the simple fact that most campuses are now Wi-Fi enabled and so on. So while we are quizzing these students on their multiple choice exams, the reality is that they could just pull out their phones and find any answer that's on that exam. The reality is that the vast majority of human knowledge is actually floating in there all around us right now. And a better skill might actually be finding a way to harness that information, critique it, and maybe create something new out of it. Those are the types of skills that could be really powerful, not just simple rote memorization. Memorization actually has a role in education, an important role, but we need to move somewhere beyond this. So I wanted to just sort of step by step break down all of these assumptions and show you what it means when the reality is that the World Wide Web is literally all around us right now. What does it do to these assumptions? And the first thing is the idea that information is scarce is, of course, completely blown out, because we're going to produce 70 exabytes of information just this year, which is 70 billion gigabytes, which is more than the entire collection of the Library of Congress. In fact, it's a lot more. It's 518,000 libraries worth. And that's just in terms of what we will produce just this year. So this idea of information being scarce is gone, and we knew that 40 years ago. Marshall McLuhan's been saying that for a long time. So that's out. And if you do the math, it comes out to 12,000 gigabytes per person that would be produced. That's the equivalent of a stack of books 350 feet tall. Less than 0.01% of this will be on paper. And that's really important, because digital information is different than information on paper. And we need to start thinking about how it's different and what it means for education. Therefore, we need to rethink information, learning, and education. So here's a quote from Marshall McLuhan. This is the famous rearview mirror quote. He says, "We look at the present through a rearview mirror, we march backwards into the future." And here's just an example here. It's, you think about being on the so-called information superhighway, which is itself a metaphor. And we're looking in, the way that we encounter this new information environment is actually through a very deep metaphor of through the past, through print technology, so that we actually have a desktop that through which we encounter this. We put our files inside folders, and this is the way we organize information. And we're only just now starting to recognize that putting things in files and inside folders, it may not be the best way to organize digital information, that there are now new possibilities for the organization of information, and especially new possibilities when you consider that we are all networked together. And when we start sharing the information we have about organization, the whole thing starts to turn upside down. So we're really just now starting to see what we can do with digital technology and getting beyond this metaphor. And I can just go through just a few examples here. If you think about our assumptions about information in the past, a lot of it was based as information on paper. So on paper, we thought of information as a thing with a material form. You could point to it. And librarians and other people were really engaged in this activity, which is putting it in its logical place in a specific hierarchy of categories. So each information object actually had a specific place in this hierarchy. And then when we have the World Wide Web come around, Yahoo actually continues this tradition, so that the first web catalog, being Yahoo 1995 and then on into 1996, they actually put each website within a specific category. Even though that website could have existed in multiple categories, because electronic information is not this type of physical object, they tended to put it just in one specific category. Then hyperlinking started to show us something new, and we're still sort of unpacking the power of the hyperlink. We still don't quite understand all the things that it can do. But the one thing it showed us early on is that information can be in more than one place at one time. And then Google started harnessing these links and showed us that we might not need the hierarchies. So that now today, most people don't even start with any sort of categorization scheme. When we start our research, we usually start with a search. And that has really changed the way we do research. And then that was 1998 when Google started coming out. Blogger starts to come around 99, 2000, 2001, becomes really popular in 2003. And it shows us that anybody can be a creator of information. And this really starts to flip the scales here. So that today there's 112.8 million blogs, and if you're keeping track, that's almost 112.8 million more than there were in 2003. Because it just was like almost not around in 2003, and now blogs are everywhere, and that's just in the last 5 years. And it's the same thing with TV and video. If you think back to 1948, this is the date that ABC started broadcasting. They became the third major network in the United States to broadcast. So since that time, that's 1948, that's 60 years, and if you have three networks, and if you give them the benefit of the doubt and you say, for those 60 years, they've been broadcasting 365 days for 24 hours each and every day, that would be over 1.5 million hours of programming, which is a lot. And when Marshall McLuhan said we live in an information age, he was talking about this, but YouTube has produced more in the past 6 months. And they did it without producers. They did it with people just like you and me, just uploading stuff, you know, all kinds of stuff. And so now we have over 9,000 hours a day being uploaded to YouTube. It's the equivalent of almost 400 always-on TV channels, but it's not always-on TV channels because they're actually 200,000 three-minute videos. And I've been doing a ton of research on YouTube lately, so I've watched about 12,000 videos in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And trust me that this is not mass media. This is most of these videos are destined to be viewed and are meant to be viewed by less than 100 people. So this is really a different type of medium that's happening here. And 88% of this stuff is new and original content, which is actually better than the networks do. So there's something going on here, and the first thing that you notice here is the idea of following along is completely out, because now we have students and everyday people are actually producing information and media on their own. So this whole idea of following along is being subverted. Meanwhile, people are also recognizing through sites like Wikipedia that everyday people, normal people, amateurs, can work together in new ways and create information that rivals the content of experts. So there's this whole new idea of collective intelligence and the possibilities of this, and it's really exciting. Kevin Kelly has this great quote. It says, "Nobody is as smart as everybody," and I think that's turning out Wikipedia is becoming pretty good evidence of this. So this whole idea of trusting authority for good information, it's not that we don't still need authority for some things, but trusting authority for good information is certainly being challenged. Our whole idea of authority is being challenged. So this whole idea of obeying the authority is out. And this one is the real big one, that authorized information is beyond discussion. It turns out that to authorize information, we need to see the discussion. And that's what's great about Wikipedia. And when we use it in our classrooms, we can actually tell our students, you know, don't stop at the front page, go to the discussion page, find out how that information was actually produced, find out about the discussion behind the scenes, and then check the sources to see that other bigger discussion that's happened behind the scenes. And therefore, our students can actually find authority inside the discussion through actually like analyzing the evidence and so on, not just relying on an expert. Instead, they're getting right into the midst of things and really doing some critical thinking. Now, what's really great about the web today is that even like typical Web 1.0 sites, so here's a typical Web 1.0 site, meaning it's just text, there's no interactive stuff on here. There are now programs that allow you to interact on these pages as well. So here's a little site called Digo, which allows you to actually highlight anything on that web page and then put a comment on there. You can share that comment with a group of people, with the world, however you want to share that comment. And you can actually have discussions emerge right on the page. And so we've had little discussions emerge right on the web, all over on the web, wherever we have a reading for the class. So this idea of authorized information is beyond discussion is certainly out. And then this one here, being that the idea that it's being hard to find. This is a big one because people say we have tons of information today, and it's just information overload. And how do you find good information? Well, it turns out that even as we're doing this, as we're marking up the web, this is actually then being aggregated into different lists. So we have things like Delicious and Digo, where, for example, on Delicious, you can actually tag something, and as you're tagging it, it's actually organizing it because your tags are being shared with other people. How many people do tagging? So I probably don't need to explain the tagging. A tag is basically just like a folder. But the idea here is that you can actually put the same thing in many, many folders. And then you share all of your tags with other people. And that in aggregate, it becomes what people call a folksonomy. Like it actually is sort of a organized from the bottom up. And we can do all of this without folders. So we're actually organizing the web beyond the metaphor of folders. And the stuff on the web is actually, I'm finding fantastic information much easier than ever. And I'm finding it through social networks, through people who are like me. In fact, George Siemens, who might be here, or he may be watching by webcast virtually here. But I follow his blog, and I follow him on Twitter and this type of stuff, and I get tons of stuff through George Siemens. And that's the type of social network that you can create where you end up finding some great information. So here's then my homepage, and I'll just give you an idea of how this works. The moment somebody tags something with the word anthropology or Web 2.0 or future of education or anything that I'm interested in, it immediately comes to my front page. And some people might use Google Reader or something like that. You can also set up Google Reader to do this. This is NetVibes here. And the moment somebody tags, say, a picture and they tag it with the word anthropology, it immediately shows up on my front page. Blogs are the same way. And this is all through RSS. And therefore, RSS is actually teaching us that information can find us. So instead of us going out to find information and struggling through this huge bunch of material, RSS is actually bringing this information to us. And it works for everything from websites and blog posts all the way to high-end, research materials, journals and stuff like that. So I have even like major journals. The moment somebody publishes something that has something to do with my field, it shows up on my front page immediately. So you keep up with the research remarkably well this way. So this idea of it being hard to find is also out. And so finally, we're left with nothing but to learn is to acquire information. And clearly, if you think about navigating this world I just showed you, learning is not about acquiring information at all. There's something bigger here. There's something more that needs to be done. And this is where there's a real shame here that we do exams like this. You know, this is our major form of assessment. And meanwhile, these walls are not telling us that to learn is to discuss information, challenge, critique, share, create. And ultimately, what we need to be doing is helping students create meaningful connections, because that's where learning really happens. And that's where we're really talking about creating significance. And that's what learning is really all about, is creating these meaningful connections, creating significance. And that allows the students, that's something that sticks with the students when they actually create this type of significance. So how can we create significance? How can we create meaningful connections? And how can we create students who can create meaningful connections? That's the core question that we need to ask. So this is where I'm going to get all academic on you guys real quick and just talk about two types of meaningful connections. This comes out of my background is in symbolic anthropology, and so some of this is going to be sort of grounded in that type of material. The first idea here is I'll give you an idea of semantic meaning. This is there's two meanings of meaning here, and the first one is semantic, which is to say a word, a concept, or idea is not just meaningful for what it is, but for how it relates, connects, and contrasts with other words, concepts, and ideas. And therefore, when a student learns something, they can't just learn a thing. They have to learn that thing's relationship with all these other things in order to truly understand its significance. And so that's what we mean by semantic meaning. The second one is sort of personal meaning, and this is maybe the way you might think of it in terms of your own identity and so on. And that is that a person finds their own meaning and significance, their identity, not just in who they are, but in how they relate, connect, and contrast with other people. So we often think of ourselves as individuals and defined internally, but in fact we're constantly defining ourselves based on our relationships with other people. The famous theorist here is Cooley, who talks about the looking glass self. We actually sort of know ourselves through the eyes of others and how we relate to others and how we contrast with others. So any sort of form of personal meaning has to do with our connections with other people around us. And then the third thing I want to point out is that these two are inseparable and interdependent when it comes to learning. So there's this great line from Barbara Harrell Carson where she says, it's sort of integrating these two types of meaning, saying that students learn what they care about from people they care about and who they know care about them. It's all about connection, both between within the material and also between students and faculty and among students themselves. So how do we create significance? I'm going to give you like three things, and then I'm going to launch you into my portal and show you my own experiments in education. So the first thing is that we need to somehow find a grand narrative to provide relevance and context for the learning. So you have to have a big picture. Like no matter what your course is, if you're just dumping random bits of information and it's not clear how it all connects, they're not going to find anything significant in that, and they're not going to learn anything. So this is sort of addressing that semantic bit of meaning. If you have a big picture that's really significant to the students, then they'll really grab onto it and they'll learn a great deal. The second thing is to create a learning environment that values and leverages the learners themselves, which is to say that when I walk into a classroom of, say, 200 people, the first thing to think about is, like, these are all bright, creative people. Somehow I just need to unleash that. Somehow I need to, like, bring them into the process and like, harness their intelligence for the betterment of this class. So it's not just me talking at them. It's us working together to create a better learning environment. So then the third thing is that we need to do all this in a way that realizes and leverages the existing media environment, meaning that we have to recognize that the web literally is all around us, and there may be ways that we can harness the web in our classrooms to create a better learning environment. And even more importantly, towards media literacy, we have to, what I like to do is actually push the students beyond what they're normally used to doing, so go far beyond Facebook and YouTube and this type of stuff, so that they can start to realize and leverage this media environment themselves, so that they start to use the media less to just entertain themselves and actually start to realize that this is a powerful tool for learning and for serving the world in whatever capacity they want to do. So this is how I kind of think about the media environment. This is just a visual of what it looks like today. And what I want to point out here is if you look at the dates of when these things are created, YouTube is 2005, okay, email is fairly old, but Blogger is fairly new, Facebook also late 2004, early 2005, MySpace is 2002, Dig is very recent, Technorati, all these things are very recent, and so the point here is that there are no natives here. And this is great news on a number of fronts. For one, it means that you're in the same boat with your students, no matter who you are. They may know all about YouTube and Facebook and how to navigate these things to entertain themselves, but they know nothing about how to use these things to learn and to and for critical thought. And more than anything, they rarely know how to use these things to create something interesting and new. And so that's where, you know, you're on the same footing with your own students. You should never feel stupid in this environment, because we're all stupid in this environment. It's all just new to all of us. And it's all just a place to experiment and play around. And the second thing that's important about this is that because there are no natives here, we cannot just assume our students are media literate and know how to navigate this world. We need to help them along. We need to show them a lot of the skills that we've learned through our, you know, through your PhD program or wherever you learned your, like, sort of critical thought and so on. We need to bring that into this media environment as well. So there's Ray Kurzweil, who talks about this law of accelerating returns. He's the famous guy who always is saying that we're in exponential times, that things are changing faster and faster and faster. And he points out that you have things like Moore's Law, where the processing speed is doubling every 18 months. You have the internet, which is doubling quickly as well. You have the decrease in the size of mechanical devices, which is actually shrinking exponentially. And all of this is discounting, though, he's sort of overlooking one other aspect, and that is that you have new applications constantly. So you have a Flickr here, a Twitter there, and a new way of relating emerges. You have new types of relating to each other constantly emerging as well, so that this media environment is constantly changing. And this picture, which I made about a year ago, is already way out of date. So it's already missing Twitter and a bunch of other stuff as well. I mean, if you follow killerstartups.com or anything like that, then you'll see there's about 30 startups every day, you know, there, and each one of them is possibly the next Facebook. And I mean, they're just like, these things are growing enormously fast. There's a lot of things out there. So the challenge for us is that we need to create a learning environment that realizes and leverages this media environment. And we're going to take this a step further and suggest that what we really need is not just learning environment, but to think about our learning environments as platforms for participation. I'll show you what I mean by that in just a second. And that these platforms for participation need to allow students to understand this emerging media environment. So as they see these new tools come in, they don't see them as simply things to entertain themselves with, which is fine, but they also see them as tools that are, you know, that can help them collaborate better, to create something new, and so on. So that they can actually, in some ways, we want them to use these new media tools rather than these tools just sort of using them. So this is the big idea. So here's back to the classroom, and I'm going to show you what we've been doing in this classroom here. Now I'm going to start off with some mild stuff, and then I'll get to the crazy stuff. So here's the mild stuff. What we did was we created a portal. This is on NetVibes, and you can go, if you go to netvibes.com/wesh, this is actually open, and you can see what it looks like live, and you can play around in it if you want. But what we have here is on the left here, let's see if I can get this to work. There. On the left, we have a Facebook application. This is just the iPhone Facebook application, so it's built right into the platform. So this is nice because students can sort of navigate their Facebook and they have all this other stuff going on at the same time. I didn't take that decision lightly. I'm still not sure if I want to keep the Facebook application there because it's obviously distracting. But it's there for now, and it's worked out well so far. Down here we just have like a Google News aggregator that's bringing in all the latest news on anthropology. This is an intro level course, so news is kind of appropriate for them. They're not, a lot of them aren't really ready to see like the latest research articles. I still put those up here, which I'll show you, but for the most part they mostly just read the news articles. Then in the middle we have, this is an RSS feed coming from our wiki, which I'll show you in just a second. Over here we have a Twitter stream, so the students can tweet to each other. I'll show you how we use that in a moment. And then down here we have, this is a DIGO feed, so this is where we can actually go out on the web and mark things up and tag things, and it all comes back here to be shared with the rest of the class. And then here, this is from Kultura.com, and this is a place where we can share a video and actually edit the video together. So I'm going to take you inside the wiki and show you what this looks like. So first off, on the front page, you can see we have like our basic schedule. In the schedule, you can see there's an easy edit button up at the top, and it has a lock on it. That's because the one thing that I control in the class is the schedule. But that's in this. This is in a class of 200 people. It would just be chaos if I let 200 people dictate, you know, like what we were going to do next. So I locked that one down, and I'm sort of the final say on that one. Everything else is unlocked, though. And so, for example, after I give a lecture or during a lecture, students will actually take notes collectively on the wiki. And what's the outcome of this has been that I don't have to share very many of my notes at all. I don't have to, like, put my notes out there. Instead, the students are creating the notes, and they're the best notes I've ever seen because they're augmented with YouTube videos, Wikipedia articles, all kinds of stuff that either supports my arguments or goes against it. And the best moments are, of course, the ones that go against your argument, because then it creates a moment of discussion and reflection. And one of the things I liked was that I could actually see what was significant to the students. So, for example, here I was lecturing about Metaphors We Live By. It's a book by Lakoff and Johnson, and it's this great book that basically asks you to sort of consider the types of metaphors that are embedded in our everyday language that are all around us. So I use the example of this idea of finding yourself. So, like, the students are all involved in this. Like, most students, say 17 to 21 years old, are all, like, really intent on finding themselves. But of course, that's a metaphor, because you can't actually find yourself. And so I just asked them to, you know, start thinking about another metaphor, and we started brainstorming metaphors. Like, you know, you could say, instead of finding yourself, think about creating yourself, or even losing yourself. Maybe losing yourself is the answer, you know, in a sort of Buddhist way. And ultimately, they wrote this down, and they were so excited about it. They put it in red, they wrote it down twice, they put it in bold, and all this stuff. And meanwhile, the question that I was going to ask them about this on the exam was, who wrote the book Metaphors We Live By, and what year was it written? Which is a really stupid question. And the better question is something based on this, right, that grabs that significance of the learning. And somehow, it would be much better if I could have created a question around this. So the cool thing about having the students take the notes was it allowed me to reflect on what my real message was and what the impact of my message was in my lectures. So then, of course, there's discussion sections on the wiki, and every wiki page has its own discussion section, so they can talk about specific parts. Then this is where people really got sold on the wiki, and I'll just mention that when I started this, 200 students on this wiki, I did a survey at the beginning, and only 5 people had ever edited a wiki before. So this is what I mean by media literacy, not being there necessarily. And in fact, over half the class did not actually know that a wiki could be edited. So even though they're looking at Wikipedia all the time, they don't even realize necessarily that that is a wiki and that it can be edited. So there's a lot of media literacy problems around that. But this is where I really sold them, because we had an exam and I just put up 40 words on the wiki that they needed to know something about for the exam. And I didn't want to put anything else into it. I wanted them just to you know, learn on their own. And what happened was, very quickly, within 24 hours after I posted this, it turned into an 11-page like document of, you can see how they expanded every single word. They added YouTube videos and pictures and all this type of stuff. And it became the best exam review sheet I've ever seen. And the cool thing was, behind the scenes, I can actually see, you know, I could see like my own editions, and then I could see everybody's edition after that. And I could see exactly how many words they added. I could see what words they added. And if you look over here to the left, you can see there's pictures of people, and those pictures actually get bigger with the more contributions they make. So if you're like really active, then your face gets really big. So it's sort of just like, at a glance, you can actually see like the participation happening. You can see who's participating and so on. And all of this, all these updates immediately come back here. So the moment a student makes an update, it comes back here. So this is why I put Facebook here, was because my hope was that students would start using Facebook here, and then they could see like immediately, oh, look, somebody just like added some notes on the exam review, and they can go and check it out. So it's similar to, there's now some libraries have started putting some of the library books inside the food court and that kind of thing, because they can't get students to the library, but maybe they can bring the library to the students. So this is a similar model, sort of virtually. Then over here we have Digo, which is a lot like Delicious, which allows students to go around the web. So for example, they can be on this web page here, And they can actually highlight something on the web, leave a note, tag it to organize it, and they can actually leave notes to each other. They can have conversations with each other, and so on. So you have these conversations emerging right on the web page. And all of that then is also coming back here. So as students are exploring the web, all this information is then coming back to the to this portal here. Those same links can also be embedded on any of the wiki pages. So these are actual live feeds that are on the wiki pages here. Then up at the top, you can see there's multiple tabs in this portal. So I use one of the tabs here for research articles and for like blogs put out by scholars that are based on the topics that we're studying. So there's maybe I have 20 blogs here or so. And students can go there at any time and sort of get the latest research and that kind of thing. Now, what's really fun is how I can use this portal in a smaller class. So I showed you how it worked in a bigger class. There's some even more exciting things you can do in a small class. So if we go over here, the first tab is my smaller class, which is only 7 to 10 students, and it's mostly research oriented. And what's cool about this is because it's research oriented, we can actually, instead of have a syllabus where I dictate what we're going to do and how we're going to do it, we start off with a research question. And then collectively we work together to figure out, well, what are we going to need to know to answer this question? And then the students can sort of map out their own path together. And so we have, instead of a syllabus, we had a sandbox. And students could actually map out the path through that sandbox. And then they can also give each other a to-do list and they can accomplish these to-dos. So that to-do will actually show up at the top of a page. So here we were looking at YouTube communication structures, and you can see somebody added a fact check, which actually I don't think was ever done. We need to go back and do that. And here you can see, this is one example of something we did where we did a history of YouTube, where in one weekend we had 10 of us at the time. So it's a class of 10 people. And we looked up on LexisNexis, which basically scours the all the, like, you can find all the magazine and newspaper articles and so on that have been written about a particular topic. So we did a search for YouTube, and it was massive, you know, well over 1,000 articles at the time. So there's no way a single person could read all these. So instead, we broke them up into 10 parts, and each one of us had to read a certain number of articles and summarize them on this wiki page. And within one weekend, we were able to basically read every article that was ever written about YouTube and have it summarized and put it into a timeline. And then the next weekend, one of the students took this timeline and created a video, which became like the history of YouTube video. And then within 3 weeks from the moment we started, we had this thing up, this history of YouTube video up, which is, it's like a little amateurish, but it's not bad. And over 30,000 people have seen it now, you know. And it's kind of nice just for like a little, just a thing that was a great learning exercise and also ended up contributing something. So then we started thinking about in this small class, and this ultimately failed, but we had this radical proposal, this radical idea, which was that students could actually grade themselves. And if you want to like pin me down afterwards, I can tell you all the reasons why this failed. But the cool idea was that we realized that this tracks so much everything that you do that it's very transparent. So any student can go on and see exactly what other students have contributed to the project. And the impetus behind it was a lot of the students were saying that they work harder for their peers than they do for their professors, you know, because they feel that peer pressure and they want to perform for their peers. So we wanted to harness that in some way, but it ended up failing. The short version of why it failed was because one of the students was consistently failing to do things on time. And in a collaborative project, that can be really troublesome. And yet, the student was really well-liked, so nobody wanted to grade them down. And so you ended up with somebody with a very low A, but still an A, you know, when clearly they didn't deserve an A. And so I eventually had to sort of step in and say, you know, this, we need to do something here. So that's why it failed. And I'm not convinced that it's not possible. I think it's still possible, but needs some adjustment. So here you can see all the different ways they can see what each other's doing. So then back here at the homepage, this is another research thing we were able to do where we put a YouTube window on the left. And on the right, this is Zoho Creator, which allows you to create a database form. And students can watch the YouTube videos on the left, enter data on the right, and all that data then goes to a web spreadsheet that's web-based so students can see it. They can download that into SPSS or whatever analysis program they might be using and then get statistics on it. So we just ran a few basic statistics on YouTube, and a lot of the statistics you saw earlier were based on some of the research we did together. And then, of course, we don't just put it on the wiki. We push it out to the blog because we have, you know, several hundred people watching us on the blog. And what's cool about this then is that we get instant feedback from all over the world. So we post it on the blog, and then we get people from Brazil and all over the world talking back to us about it. So it's this really great platform for us. And then the students publish their own videos on the blog. And just to show you how all of this is integrated, the moment they post something on the blog, of course, it's also on YouTube, and it also appears back on the front page as well. Like the video, all of that is completely integrated. So this is where things get kind of, I'm going to start getting crazy on you guys now, because I started realizing that everything I was doing in the small class, I could do in the big class, and in fact, if I could get it to work in the big class, it would be like, I don't know, 40 times better, because it has 40 times as many people, right? If somehow I could harness all of the knowledge and experience and creativity that's in this room is actually much more powerful than this room. It's just a matter of getting it to work together, getting all these students to work together. So I did the one experiment, a lot of you guys have probably seen this, where I took the 200 students and we just brainstormed about the classroom itself. So we opened up a Google document and had these 200 students edit on this, and we had ended up with almost 400 revisions, additions to this. It became the script for this video, which ended up having, I think, probably about 2 million views now, and it reached number one on Technorati. It was translated into 5 languages. All within like 2 months, within that same class, and ended up on ABC News. I mean, this was like quite the little experiment, but it was really pretty mild compared to what we really thought we could do. You know, so this is some of the basic logic behind what I was trying to do with my students. So if you think about like the value of the students themselves. So here, I'm going to start off with, this is two students. This is a picture of two students here. And if you think about these two students, they could have a relationship between them, and that relationship is where the value is. Like, it's through that connection and the conversation between the two that's where the value is. But that's also very hard to maintain. Any sort of relationship is hard to maintain, but the value is in it if you can somehow maintain it. If you add a third person, you're not just adding a third person, you're actually adding two more relationships, which adds a great deal of complexity. So if you know how it is, like a single relationship is one thing. Adding a third person, you add two more relationships, it gets complicated. Adding a fourth, you're adding three more relationships. Adding a fifth, you're adding four more relationships, so that 5 people actually have 10 relationships. This is classic Metcalfe's law, that the number of links is n times n minus 1 over 2, so that if you have 12 people, you have 66 relationships. So this is, 12 people is actually a very valuable network if you can get everybody to work together, but it's also very challenging. 66 links is both great potential, but also very difficult to do. So somehow we need to get it to all work together. Instead, what we see in classrooms is as this network gets bigger and more complicated, normally the teacher just sort of steps out. And the teacher steps out and then creates a single relationship with each student. That's sort of the best case scenario. And a lot of the relationship between students are actually sort of mitigated or done away with. As this grows, and you would get bigger classrooms, so you end up with, say, a big classroom of 200 people, it's just this big mass. And you end up with the typical model for teaching a class of 200 is that the teacher stands up the front, and those are the students there, and it's sort of there an amorphous mass, and you just talk out to this mass. And somehow, though, we have to realize that we can do better. So there's one option is to create a hierarchy, and this is what organizations do to work better together. But we don't want that in the classroom. That's not going to work in the classroom. And more importantly, you think about the message that's being sent with each of these models. In the network model, you're sending a message of participation. And I think this is a very strong and good message to be sending. In a model of hierarchy, you're sending the message of obey authority, which isn't necessarily all bad, but it's also not necessarily the best one. And then in a mass situation, you're sending the message of follow along, which is a really, I think, a bad message to be sending. So ultimately, though, how do we get these huge classrooms into a network situation where everybody's participating and the value then is really tremendous? So going beyond Metcalfe's law, Some of you may be familiar with Reed's Law, the idea that the number of possible subgroups is basically 2 to the nth, so it's exponential in the sense of how it grows with each person. And that's where the real power of the network is, but only if you can get it to work. So how do we get this big class to work just like the small class in this like really tight network situation? So this is what I've done in this classroom, and this is where things get kind of crazy and wild, and I wouldn't recommend this for just any classroom, but maybe that there's something analogous in your own classroom that you can borrow from this. But this is what I do. The first thing I do is I try to create something that's really deeply significant to the students, because the first thing you need is the students to be really engaged. This is going to take a lot of energy to make it work, and so you need the students to be right there with you. So what I do is I lay down a world map on top of them, and it's a fake world map. And each student then is actually designated as the expert on whatever part of the world they end up in. They have to know everything about the environment they end up in, everything about the various cultures that have existed. This is a class about human. This is an intro to cultural anthropology, which is basically the learning goal is to know as much as possible about all humans through all time in all places. And so it's kind of a broad learning goal. But so what we do is each student then becomes like the expert in the classroom on some particular environment and the cultures that have existed in those environments. And the outcome here is that in many cases there will be students in the room who know more about some particular subject than I do. And that really flips the scales of how things work in the classroom. Then we look at our real world to really add some significance to this, and we say, well, let's take stock of our world and where we are today, and what this really means. And so we find the students get on the wiki and we start gathering information. And some of the things we find are things like this: that 1.3 billion live on less than a dollar a day, 3 billion living on less than $2 per day, 800 million are undernourished, over 27,000 will die of poverty today. And then the question is why? And the whole class then becomes a very simple class in a sense. We just want to know, why is this the case? Why is the world the way it is today? And how did we end up here? And the bigger question here is, what do we need to know for this test? Because of course the students are thinking about, where are we going in the future with this? And it has to, and this is what's really important about building significance in the classroom, is somehow you have to go beyond the grade. You have to give some sense of meaning that's far beyond the grade. And I think that's what can be really powerful. So here we are back in this classroom, and the students then basically start to group up in these different environments. And it'll end up being like 12 people in each environment. So we end up with about 15 to 20 different cultures, you might say, in these different environments. And they end up creating their own cultures that look like this. We create a whole world that's sort of an alternative world that actually has a lot of the same characteristics of our real world, but it becomes a place where they can play with some ideas and different theories about how the world works without necessarily having to feel like they are like they're dealing with real world issues. We don't necessarily want specific historical events, for example, to color this analysis. We wanted something a little bit more abstract. In a later class, in an upper level class, we actually do the same thing, but we use real world events and we start to work in real history and think about things like that. But in this class, we wanted it to be more abstract. So this is what it looks like. Then the students go on the wiki and they actually start creating their own ethnography. So each group of 12 creates a 20-page ethnography right there on the wiki. And you can see what it looks like. They describe everything about their culture, and it has to be a culture that's completely realistic. They have to actually read a lot of material about other real cultures in the real world to build their cultures. And all of their cultures are built as if it's the year 1450, and I'll show you why that is in just a second. Because at the end of class, then, what we end up with is a world as if it's the year 1450. It's as close as we can get to predicting or to thinking about how the world would have looked in the year 1450. Then we go into this big ballroom, and each of the cultures sort of occupies their land, which is represented by one of these tables here. And then they have to generate rules for a simulation So this is called the world simulation here. And they generate rules about how the world works so that they can create this game that will actually allow history to unfold in some realistic way since the year 1450. So what the neat thing about this is it's not just them sort of looking at history. They have to, of course, look at history to see what the markers are. But at the same time, they're trying to think, like, okay, so how did this happen? Like, in sort of a bigger perspective, like, how does the world work that it unfolded in this particular way? And so they end up sort of brainstorming rules for what turns out to be sort of an alternate reality game. And in order to do this, you know, they have to, like, go into some really great literature of anthropology. They have to look at some of the theories that have been around about how human beings interact, how cultures interact, and so on. And so they end up scouring the web in all these different places to find this stuff. And this is where we ended up with, you know, is anybody an anthropologist in here? Yeah. So, like, we ended up in intro class talking about Wallerstein's world systems theory, which usually is something you get to in a either very upper level undergrad or in a graduate level course. But the students were sort of, you know, really devouring this stuff because they thought, okay, this is where we can really build something and build a game out of this stuff that might work. And so in many ways, we ended up focusing on this theory and actually building a game around this theory that in a way tests the theory, or at least exposes the theory to some scrutiny. And so here we are with the rules, and then we implement them. As the rules get updated, they come back here, so people are continually adding to them. And then this is what it looks like on the day of. So all of this is ran through, like, within a single class period. So 75 minutes, you go through 600 years of history, which is a pretty wild game to play. And basically how it works here, you can see a few scenes here. Students create envelopes and with little instructions to each other that describe some of the basic outlines of what they want different groups to do. Then we use different props. Like, in this case, we had Fruit Loops, which represented sort of the produce of the place of the culture. And the neat thing about that is it allowed people who were sort of expansionists, like this in this case we have a colonizer coming in and actually suggesting to these indigenous people that we can help you be more prosperous. You know, let us take your Fruit Loops, we'll show you how to make more money, this kind of thing. There's a similar process as what's happened in colonization. And of course, once they give up their Fruit Loops, then they're dependent on the world system for their subsistence. And so here's what it looks like. We have all these colonizers going out and colonizing the world. By 40 minutes in, the entire world is colonized. And then this is later. There you have this round of decolonization. A bunch of the places start to build up more strength and so on, and they end up throwing out their colonizer. But in the end, we ended up in this particular case with these alliances. We had a Northern Alliance, a Central Alliance, and a Southern Alliance. The Central Alliance being basically the world powers. And this is a huge system that these students created. It had an economic system. It had its own. It had a whole bunch of different elements to it, including natural resources. So these yellow cards represented natural resources. And what we did was we put just enough into the game so that it would take us through to the year 2050, which was roughly where we thought we might hit a situation of peak oil or something like that. And so we put them in there, and we play the game through the year 2100, sort of virtually. And so we end up with these last two yellow cards. And this is a situation where you would hope that the world would come together and sort of figure things out and, you know, like, create a new form of energy or something like that. But instead, the world powers go down and they decide to fight. And this was interesting because we had sort of built in, what was interesting about it is we had built in all these rules about how the world works, and it's sort of discouraging to see this happen. But at the same time, then, you know, we have 2 or 3 weeks left in class, and we can come back to the classroom and say, okay, so you guys are going to live through what you guys just experienced. How could we do it better? Like, is there a solution that we missed? You know, and so it's a really great exercise, I thought. So here you can see what happens. If you look at the economy that was created, it was really remarkable because it turns out that just like in the real world, about half the students are working for almost nothing, and they ended up making Fruit Loop necklaces for the powerful colonizers, who then would wear their Fruit Loop necklaces around, like, sort of, like, you know, bragging to everybody else about their great Fruit Loop necklaces. And there's a lot of analogies to be made with the real world and how that's happened. Meanwhile, the people, as they make these Fruit Loop necklaces, were actually being paid very, very little or just enough to buy Cheerios, which were grown in the colonizing area. So the colonizers had Cheerios, and they would then sell their Cheerios so that they could have these Fruit Loop necklaces. Then after the simulation, we have 2 or 3 weeks left, and we create a wiki page for the history, and the students can work together to create the history together. This last year, we actually ended up creating the history in class, which I want to point out that the technology is sort of secondary. What's more important is the collaboration. So in this last year, it just turned out that we had a whole day of working in class together, which is probably even better than the wiki. So I just want to point out that the wiki is cool, but sometimes face-to-face is even better. And so in this case, we collaborated in the classroom to create the history. And then this history, you know, it always gets uploaded there. This is something that we added cool, that was really cool this year, was we added Twitter along with Jot to the simulation. So does anybody know what Jot is? So yeah, a few of you. So Jot just sort of transcribes your voice into text. So this is a call I made where it says, "Hi class, I'm uploading this from my phone, and I thought this might be a cool way to add updates to the world simulation." It actually spelled simulation as stimulation. It doesn't always get it right. but it's cool because it transcribes your voice, and you can call Twitter, basically, and Twitter then broadcasts it out to your network. And so if you create a network as your class, then you can basically call Jot, and it will broadcast it out to your class, basically. That's how that works. And I'll just show you a video of what this looks like. We also, I'll just mention, we video record this entire thing on about 20 cameras. So each culture has a camera person, and that camera person then takes that video, edits that video down to about a 5-minute clip that just shows like the major events that happened in their culture. Then all those 5-minute clips are sent to me, and then I aggregate them into a final video that shows the entire world history and how it happened. And this, what normally this is like a 20-minute video, so I took our 20-minute video and I just compressed it down to 5 minutes, just so, and I'm just going to talk over it so you get a sense of what it looks like. This is what the activity actually looks like here. And this was just done like a month ago. So this is the classroom. And this is the YouTube video we created. It might look familiar. So then this is just describing how it works here. So this is what the world looks like. And you can see like students are sort of, in the beginning, they're just sort of like shaking hands. They're trading. You can see the note cards are trading. They're just meeting each other. They have all types of secret handshakes and stuff. So it's all kind of fun and games for the first 10 or 15 minutes. And these are the major colonizers. And you can see they have these cards that represent hard power. Basically military might, you might say. And they go out and they start colonizing people. And you can see all the flags going up. These are different colonies being created. And you can see almost the entire map is colonized by this time. And meanwhile, up at the top, people are sending in their Twitters. So as we're doing this, we're actually seeing how things are unfolding. Because at the front of the room, we have a big screen like this with the Twitter feed going live. And here you see, this is a war over Fruit Loops that's emerging right here. One of the things we did was we actually had, we have news reports during the simulation where I stand up as a news anchor, and they're sponsored by different things. And one of the things, we have a Fruit Loop necklace commercial, which after that commercial, then all the students want Fruit Loop necklaces, and that's why you end up with this sort of economy emerging. Here's where the natural resources are actually little yellow cards that are cut up and put inside sacred objects of indigenous people, so that sacred objects are actually destroyed in order to get to these objects, which is sort of metaphorical. You know, a lot of natural resources are on lands, sacred lands, and so on. And here you can see they're starting to rebel. So this is a time when a lot of the colonies are starting to rebel. But meanwhile, the major powers are starting to realize that they can rule sort of economically. And this is where Wallerstein's world systems theory comes in, if you're familiar with that. They basically create an economic empire at this time. And most of the world is now working for Cheerios. And here you can see Sasnak made $23,000 and paid about $300 in wages. Just to give you a sense how imbalanced the economy has become. And then we had a series of world wars, which is really interesting because this is completely unplanned. And yet, just at that critical moment, we had a series of world wars emerge, much like we did in the real world. And here you have people actually protesting, sitting down at work and deciding we're not going to work for Cheerios anymore. And in this case, they were actually killed off. This is actually a genocide situation, which again like has its analogies in the real world, unfortunately. We even had a civil war emerge, which ended in a genocide, which is a lot like Rwanda, because there's a situation where some people have been empowered by the colonizers. This is actually the place, a really sad situation, because it matched Rwanda so closely. And here you can see towards the end, this is massive war emerging, because there's no more natural resources, there's a lot of distrust. Kind of had a sad ending in this particular case. It's not always a sad ending. And you notice that we used a lot of documentary sources to sort of supplement our video. And all these are found by students who write in or they submit a video and say, you know, like this that happened in the simulation is a lot like this piece from this video. We put it all together and it ends up looking like this. So that's what that little exercise looks like. Let's go back to... All right, so I'll just show you a few more things here to close out. You can see this is kind of the video that's created from all of this on these 20 cameras. What we didn't do this time, what we hope to do next time, is use Kaltura to actually edit the video together. But it's really hard to do if you've ever used Kaltura or any online collaborative video thing. Video is very like memory intensive, like it takes a lot of bandwidth and so on. And it was just too hard to do. It just didn't work fast enough. But then you can see we upload it to YouTube, which has been great because we get a bunch of people commenting on it and talking to us about it. And it just expands that conversation that much further. Now in the future, we want to do one more thing that I'll mention, and that is, some of you may be familiar with two-dimensional barcodes. Are these used much in Canada? Does this look familiar to anybody? So some say yes, some say no. So this is basically an actual URL, and if you have a cell phone, you can actually take a picture of this, and it would actually load the URL into your cell phone. And so you can imagine that we can integrate this with our game in some way, so that these things could be around the room or they could be on little cards or something like that. And they could actually, we're not exactly sure what to do with it just yet, but the great thing about the way this class works is that it's not just on me to figure out how this will be useful. You know, I just mention it to my students and then I have 200 people sort of thinking about it. And maybe one of them will come up with a great idea. And that's where you get that value of the network, you know, because you have all these people working on the same project thinking about it. You can see these two-dimensional barcodes are already popping up in all types of things all over the world. So the challenge then for us, as I mentioned earlier, was to create these platforms for participation. And the reason why I'm integrating now these two-dimensional barcodes and all this other stuff, it may look like overkill, but the real key here is to also to allow students to realize and leverage this media environment. And not just the media environment, but the media environment of tomorrow, because this is all happening very fast and changing very quickly. Some of you guys may be interested in learning more about the future. These are some resources you might want to look at. The Horizon Report from EDUCAUSE is very good. There's a great survey from UNESCO, the Ethical Implications of Emerging Technologies. And what's really interesting about all these, though, is that they all agree on one trend, and that trend is toward ubiquitous networks, ubiquitous computing, ubiquitous information at unlimited speed about everything, everywhere, from anywhere, on all kinds of devices. And we really have to start designing our courses in recognition of this in a way that leverages this reality and doesn't sort of push it off to the side as if it's not true. Because we also need to be thinking about not just preparing our students for this world, but the reality is that this information environment that's emerging is not a download-only world, it's an upload world. It means that our students are going to be creating the media environment of the future. They're going to be creating the content and the value and the information of the future. So we really have to be thinking about how we prepare our students to create this world. So I'm just suggesting here that we generally move from a closed system to an open system, from control to enable, from structure to platform, and finally, I'll just leave you with this little turn of phrase, that we need to move students from being knowledgeable to being knowledge-able, meaning like able to actually, you know, create and critique and so on, all this types of information. So that's all I got today, and then I'll open it up for questions. Thanks.